Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, music, race, incarceration, and survivor testimonies from apartheid South Africa. On Friday, February 10th, Dr. Janie Cole from the Center for African Studies at the University of Cape Town came to Indiana University to speak about studying music in apartheid South Africa. Dr. Cole is the founder and executive director of Music Beyond Borders, an organization that, quote, is dedicated to research, cultural heritage preservation, publications, and film documentaries in which crimes against humanity and socio-political conditions of oppression, violence, protest, and freedom are critical. Dr. Cole came to discuss her research along with a documentary that she is creating entitled Keeping Time, the story of music in the apartheid prisons. We begin today's episode with Susan Ferrantino's introducing the lecture.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on a Friday afternoon. My name is Susan Ferrantino, and I do various outreach career programming type things for the Department of History, and one of them is the speaker series, organizing a speaker series on historical teaching and practice. And the overarching idea of the speaker series is explorations of the work that historians do, both in the classroom and in the wider world. So we're very excited to have Janie Cole here to speak with us today on the work she's doing. So to formally introduce her, I'm going to turn things over to Alex Lichtenstein. To introduce her, I will simply say, if you are interested in receiving emails about future events in this series, come up and see me after the talk today and I can get you on the list. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Sue. Thanks for hosting this. So, this is the fourth time that I've introduced Janie. The fourth time this week, and I try and shift around the details each time according to the audience, because it's been a really nice series of events where she's spoken at the music school, to the Black Film Center and Archives in Wells, to African Studies this afternoon, and now to historical teaching and practice. So let me try an introduction that fits that remit. So in one sense, Dr. Cole has the most traditional of academic CVs. She went to the University of London, she got a PhD in music and Italian, she wrote a couple of books about Baroque Italian and French music, very traditional academic career. Yet, she also worked in the Rare Books and Manuscripts Department at Christie's Auction House in New York. So an interesting deployment of her historical musicological skills, to be sure. And what I'm trying to get to here is precisely how what you learn, because I know a lot of your graduate students in your PhD program, has many different kinds of applications. So finding herself in Cape Town, South Africa, Janie became intrigued, as most people who go to Cape Town do, by the history of Robben Island, the apartheid-era prison on which Nelson Mandela and a whole host of political prisoners were locked up by the white supremacist government. And anyone who goes to goes to Cape Town, visits Robben Island, which is this amazing historical and heritage site, which is a deep and rich history, but also is kind of a preeminent public history site. Globally, really, it's a World Heritage Site. David Phelan has spent time looking at it. He also does research on South Africa. So bitten by the historical and heritage bug in South Africa, Dr. Cole took her musicological skills, removed them from the 17th century European context and put them into the 20th century South African context by deciding to do an oral history and musicological and ultimately documentary film project based on the testimonies of former political prisoners, both at Robben Island, many of whom are quite well known, but also with, as she'll talk now, with the political prisoners who weren't quite as high profile as Nelson Mandela. including women imprisoned, not at Robben Island, but another prison. So really, the reason that I got in touch with Sue and thought this would be a good venue for this was precisely to illustrate how the skills that one develops in an academic context, if you're flexible, can be deployed elsewhere. And I think you'll see with great excitement the kind of historical, musicological, ethnographic, and even film work that Dr. Cole has been doing. So she now also teaches at the University of Cape Town in the School of Music and at African Studies. But really, I think the heart and soul of what she's been presenting this week and why I invited her is this multifaceted research project on the history and experience of political prisoners in South Africa, and particularly their musical experience and what she calls the soundscape which they have created and which she now is investigating through. So, Janie, I'll turn over the floor to you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is said that no one truly knows a nation until one has been inside its jails. A nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest ones. And South Africa treated its imprisoned African citizens like animals. Taken from his 1994 autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela's now famous comment about the conditions in South Africa's apartheid prisons reflected the reality of thousands of activists incarcerated for protesting for racial equality and democracy during the anti-apartheid struggle. At the time of drafting his memoirs, Mandela was imprisoned in the notorious maximum security prison on Robben Island, where from 1964 he spent 18 of 27 years jailed by the Nationalist Party for his part in fighting for the eradication of apartheid, meaning separateness in Afrikaans. In 1948, the white supremacist government's apartheid policy had introduced a range of race laws and regulations that suppressed the social and civil rights of the majority of black inhabitants and privileged white minority interests. My story begins in 2011 on Robben Island, which was named Seal Island by the 17th century Dutch colonials and is located just 7 kilometres off the west coast of Cape Town at the foot of the African continent, where my extraordinary journey into recording the survivor testimonies of former political prisoners of the liberation movement began. This fieldwork forms the basis of my current research on music as a critical tool of resistance during the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, especially in the apartheid prisons, with a special focus on Robben Island and the women's jails. As a musicologist and the founder and executive director of Music Beyond Borders, I wanted to discuss today these processes that are involved in oral history with a view to developing a significant cultural heritage preservation initiative called the Ubuntu Prison Archive, to explore questions about human rights, community, memory, identity, giving voice, and gender violence. This will allow me to reflect on wider issues around the importance and power of survivor and perpetrator testimony for creating a compelling voice for raising awareness and education, the value and challenges or limitations of oral history for academic research, the academic process of collecting and editing testimony into a narrative which might give a voice to marginalized, oppressed communities, but whose voice is it anyway? And to think about how academic research, such as in history and musicology, can be applied to other formats such as documentary filmmaking for knowledge production, historical documentation, and public outreach. On Robben Island, during the apartheid period in South Africa, political prisoners were squashed into old, overcrowded military dormitories built to house a maximum of 20 men, but now home to over 60. Political prisoners slept on wafer-thin sisal mats with stinking lice-infested blankets, which did little to abate the bitter cold wind of the howling northwest Atlantic wind and hard concrete floors. On Robben Island, they were locked up with common law prisoners, some of South Africa's most notorious murderers, rapists, gang leaders, and violent criminals, who meted out any punishment through savage beatings, murders, and nightly gang rapes. Day in, day out, political prisoners were subjected to back-breaking hard labour in the stone and lime quarries, and a daily treatment of abuse, torture, painful full-body cavity searches and beatings by sadistic warders was the norm. On Robben Island, a meagre diet, strictly rationed along racial lines, left a healthy body emaciated in a matter of weeks. In such a climate of extreme physical and psychological adversity, with the prison regime making every effort to break their spirits, the political prisoners fought back. Now legendary, a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare, known as the Robben Island Bible, was passed around by Sunny Venkatrathnam, who was charged under the Terrorism Act and sent to Robben Island in 1972, who had disguised it as a Hindu Bible by covering it with pictures of Hindu gods. And basically, he asked all the leading prisoners to sign their favorite sections. Mandela's signature, dated 16th of December 1977, lies next to the passage from Julius Caesar beginning, "Cowards die many times before their deaths." Likewise, during the 1970s, political prisoners turned football into an active force against their white warders by forming the Makana Football Association with strict adherence to FIFA rules. As a musicologist, however, I wondered, where is the music? If literature, sports, politics, and other cultural activities could be central to prisoner resistance on Robben Island, as explored by historians Frank Buntman, David Shulquick, Ashwin Desai, and Chuck Kaur, amongst others, what role could musics that's so embedded in their cultural identity in a country where singing is the primary cultural expression, as opposed to the dominant drumming cultures of West Africa, what role could music have played for political prisoners fighting apartheid and incarceration? How could music or singing have played a role in their prisoner resistance and survival, given its importance in the wider anti-apartheid struggle, which has been documented to a certain extent, yet is stressed in countless personal testimonies? So I started recording oral testimonies of survivors and perpetrators of the anti-apartheid struggle with this special focus on the experiences of political prisoners from 1948 to liberation in 1994. And I first met former Robben Islanders who now act as tour guides on Robben Island, which is a national heritage site. And reactions to my inquiries were immediate and positive. The project began to snowball as these men offered more information and individuals to contact. At times, it was visibly painful for them to return to their memories, but they seemed encouraged by the fact that their experiences could be recorded permanently. Sometimes it took several meetings to gain the trust of interviewees before anything of real historical relevance was divulged. I met with archivists of the Robben Island Museum, Maibuye Archive, at the University of the Western Cape, and there found hundreds of Robben Island documents preserved, and then started rummaging around in other archives and soon found that a lot of material hadn't been looked at. So this South African project was born, and the concept of Music Beyond Borders as a cultural heritage preservation entity began to take shape, signaling the importance and power of survivor and perpetrator testimony for creating a compelling voice for raising awareness and education. From that moment of recording the first survivor testimony, which happened to be with Ahmed Kathrada, the famous struggle activist imprisoned in a single cell next to Nelson Mandela, from that moment I found I couldn't turn my back. As Peter Gabriel says in his 2006 TED Talks about the foundation of his witness organization that trains and supports people using video in their fight for human rights, Peter Gabriel says, quote, "The thing that really amazed me was that you could suffer in this way and then have your whole experience, your story denied, buried, and forgotten." Gabriel talks about torture and a victim's sense of powerlessness, how the human rights stories he heard became, quote, "very physical," and how he couldn't walk away the same. So Music Beyond Borders, you can visit the website, www.musicbeyondborders.net, is an organization dedicated to research, cultural heritage preservation, publications and film documentaries on contemporary music history in which crimes against humanity and socio-political conditions of repression, violence, protest and freedom are critical. MBB's vision is on how those suffering oppressive regimes use music to protest human rights violations and advance social justice globally. MBB aims to capture the rich cultural heritage and diversity of the human experience by transforming real stories into instruments that promote public awareness, outreach, and incite civic engagement to defend humanitarian values. And one of the central projects that we're working on is called the Ubuntu Prison Archive, Testimonies and Music from Inside South Africa's Apartheid Prisons. MBB, in collaboration with UCT, the University of Cape Town Special Libraries Special Collections, and Michigan State University's Digital Humanities Center, Matrix, is building the Ubuntu Prison Archive, which will be a rare collection of memories, music, and personal commentaries about the liberation movement garnered by way of filmed interviews, with this special emphasis on personal prison stories, human rights violations, and the critical role of music as a form of resistance expression in the notorious apartheid prisons. The name of the archive, the Ubuntu Archive, derives its name from the South African philosophical context of Ubuntu, which means, roughly speaking, I am a person through other people. My humanity is tied to yours. And this spirit of Ubuntu, togetherness, respect, human dignity, compassion, and community, that spirit is embedded in all the oral history interviews, stories, and music from the liberation struggle that are found in the archive. And so we felt that the name seemed fitting for its contents.
You have been listening to Music, Race, Incarceration, and Survivor Testimonies from Apartheid South Africa on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Dr. Janie Cole from the University of Cape Town speak about apartheid prisoners and their relationship with music. Dr. Cole is the founder of Music Beyond Borders, an organization that aims to research crimes against humanity through music. She is also creating a documentary called Keeping Time, the story of music in the apartheid prisons. Dr. Cole came to speak at Indiana University on February 10th. Now return to the program.
So the Ubuntu Prison Archive will contain recordings of original music, thus creating a unique record of this key part of South African musical history. And the music tracks are performed by surviving men and women of the liberation struggle and not previously recorded. So basically what we've been doing is reuniting former political prisoners and getting them into the recording studio. Because the repertories that they remember that they sung during this time remain as an oral tradition, and they're transmitted orally. Hardly any of it has been written down or has been published in scores. So it's music that remains in their memory, and which must be captured before this culture dies out. And so the archive in itself will include new repertories of South African freedom and political songs, hard labour songs that they sung on Robben Island in the labour quarries, personal and folk songs, and then even original works that were composed by political prisoners in prison. Then women's songs, and then music that they played or listened to. So in 2013, Music Beyond Borders reunited a group of former Robben Island political prisoners from Sharpeville Township, which was scene of the 1960 massacre, and the Pretoria area to record their prison music of survival for the first time in the South African Broadcasting Studios in Johannesburg. The group of Robben Islanders had not seen each other for over 30 years since their release, and the camaraderie that had sustained them during their long periods of imprisonment was still palpable. It was emotional for all involved. I explained the project, and needless to say, as a dedicated musicologist, I'd done extensive research to come up with a master list of tracks that I knew, mainly from first-hand interviews and archival research, had been sung on the island in different contexts, and hence, I presumed, could be recorded. The group diligently studied the list and asked questions, and then, well, the list went politely but firmly out of the window. And the Robben Islanders came up with their own track list, which far exceeded my expectations. They sang songs that they composed while behind bars, universal freedom songs, party-specific political songs, hard labour songs that kept them on their feet in the island stone quarry, folk songs from their homelands that they could teach each other in different languages. And this music, which hasn't been recorded before, will be part of the original soundtrack of the documentary film called Keeping Time, The Story of Music in the Apartheid Jails, which is currently in development and which we'll come back to in a while. So how is the Ubuntu Prison Archive a cultural heritage preservation project? Through the Ubuntu Prison Archive, the unknown foot soldiers of the struggle are given a voice. So the emphasis is very much on the veterans of the struggle whose testimonies haven't been recorded. We know what happened to the liberation leaders, but hundreds of other activists never left a trace of their involvement in the struggle. And in this way, the recording of their memories can act as catharsis and create positive change in their lives and communities. And powerful visual narratives are conveyed as learning tools so that future generations can embrace the extraordinary personal sacrifices that were necessary to create a free democratic South Africa. But what are the challenges and problematics contained in this kind of oral history? The oral histories contained in the Ubuntu Prison Archive are spoken history, subject to all the biases inherent in human recall. And of course, the issue of memory is highly problematic as a basis for historical reconstruction. Yet, they're not substantially different, you could argue, from other historical sources, such as diaries, correspondence, newspapers, photographs, which are also partial and viewed through the subjective screen of contemporary experience. The study of these oral histories, along with other contemporary sources for corroboration and authentication, therefore, gives us the potential for a detailed historical reconstruction of the apartheid era. Moreover, another important point is that oral histories and writings by former political prisoners about their struggle experiences tend to focus on the most famous apartheid prison at Robben Island, with little reference to the hundreds of other prisons and police cells where thousands of political activists were held across the country. The struggle and prison stories of female activists, especially, have been overlooked historically. So the Ubuntu Prison Archive aims to redress this imbalance in a systematic attempt to record the testimonies of men and women of all racial denominations to cover as broad a range spectrum in terms of political affiliation, ethnic origin, age, region, economic position, and prison experience. So why this focus on women's testimonies, music, and gender-based violence? Published memoirs by former political prisoners account for a very small percentage of apartheid prison literature, and these are by prominent female activists such as Winnie Mandela, Mampela Rampeli, and Ruth First, while the unknown female political prisoners' experiences have gone unrecorded, and especially those of black so-called coloured being of mixed heritage under South African racial parlance, and Indian women, such as at the infamous number 4 prison at the Old Fort in Johannesburg, which I would call the female equivalent of Robben Island. Here you can see the isolation cells of number 4 prison. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which the TRC, which recorded from 1996 to 98 some 21,000 testimonies by victims and perpetrators of apartheid concerning nearly 38,000 human rights violations committed from 1960 to 1994, has been widely criticised for its treatment of gender and for never substantially addressing South Africa's gendered past. The TRC's so-called gender-blind mandate and ad hoc approach to gender, with its lack of a systematic, proactive gender strategy, fundamentally overlooked the widely different experiences and interests of men and women involved in the struggle and victims of apartheid. The majority of statements pertain to violations committed against men, such as murder, attempted killing, severe ill treatment, and few centred on women's experiences, particularly of sexual violence. One of the shortfalls in the various stages of the TRC's process, which contributed to this inadequate attempt to incorporate gender, was its limited definition of a human rights violation, which made no specific reference to rape and other gendered-based violence under the category of severe ill treatment, thus largely excluding the wider gendered experiences of apartheid violence. And also within those definitions, which are very complex, any definition of severe ill treatment also had to be proven to be politically motivated. So if a woman was raped, it had to be proved that she was raped because of some political motivation behind it. So the women's oral histories bring to the forefront questions about African women's rights, sexual and racial discrimination, human rights violations, sexual harassment and abuse, and gender politics. They also tell of the power of music to express women's rights and as a catalyst for social revolution with the development of a specific women's struggle repertory. The archive will also comprise recordings of a specific women's musical repertory that evolved during the anti-apartheid movement to communicate a female perspective on the struggle, notably women's songs that made their presence felt in the struggle and addressed issues of gender equality and the oppression of women. So how can this kind of archive be used in education, public outreach, and to raise awareness? The study of important historical developments and events can be illuminated by the use of oral histories, which ground these large-scale events in the historical reality at a local level. Textbook history is often a pre-digested, or can be, a pre-digested synthetic version of the past, devoid of humanity and flesh and blood reality. Thus, the oral testimonies and music can serve to raise awareness and give you that refinement of detail attached to that wider historical narrative. And in this way, you can promote education and academic study of ethnic violence and genocide prevention to stimulate discussion, social engagement, and create this unknown dimension of the liberation struggle. And the idea is so that this never happens again. As Toko Umpuvlana, a political prisoner at Number 4 Women's Jail in 1976 concluded, she says, quote, "Human beings must not repeat mistakes of the past, and to communicate that through testimony and music would cut through much better than probably saying it or writing a thesis. Because if people understand what was going on, it will be a learning tool for future generations. To know what it means to dehumanize the other, and to also know that even in the midst of that dehumanization, the truth prevails. Good will always prevail over evil." So what are the processes of oral history, and whose voice is it anyway? The Booker Prize Indian author and activist, Arundhati Roy, famously said in her 2004 Sydney Peace Prize lecture that, quote, "There's really no such thing as the voiceless. There are only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard." Recent theorizations about the nature and meaning of oral history, collective memory and documentary work, headed by Michael Fisher's groundbreaking 1990 study, A Shared Authority, bring into question the notion of authorship versus authority, the nature of the voice, the impact of the production process, and the power relationship and concept of a shared authority, which lies at the core of the interviewer-interviewee interaction. A public history approach to oral history suggests a more collaborative approach to interviews, authorship versus authority, and the limits of sharing or having a shared authority. As much as you can collaborate with survivors on various outcomes, such as museum exhibitions, documentary films, NGO work, or academic publications, whoever is taking their voice and curating, filming, editing, or writing, in the end, holds the authorship. Therefore, recent scholarship tends to dispel the myth that oral history can give oppressed or marginalized societies a voice, however noble one's intentions might be, that is, give voice to the voices, because the reality is much more complex. Why? Because this view assumes people do not have a voice to begin with, which is misleading, and what Arundhati Roy is pointing to, I think. Rather, they may not have a public voice, but in their own communities, they do have a voice which is heard, and often loudly. The point, perhaps, is that because this is not public, it is therefore not recognised. So, yes, while my oral history work can give a public voice to the less exposed, the less educated, perhaps, the less formally articulate, those who are usually socially and politically the less powerful, the less heard, whose voice is it anyway?
You have been listening to Music, Race, Incarceration, and Survivor Testimonies from Apartheid South Africa on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Dr. Janie Cole from the University of Cape Town speak about apartheid prisoners and their relationship with music. Dr. Cole is the founder of Music Beyond Borders, an organization that aims to research crimes against humanity through music. She is also creating a documentary called Keeping Time, the story of music in the apartheid prisons. Dr. Cole came to speak at Indiana University on February 10th. We now return to the program.
Both Sean Field in his 2012 oral book, Oral History, Community and Displacement, Imagining Memories in Post-Apartheid South Africa, and Dan Sipe in his 1991 article, The Future of Oral History and Moving Images, explore these questions and the relationship between oral history and film. Sipe, an historian and filmmaker, believes that, quote, moving images can more fully express oral history's reflexive dimension, which makes more explicit the human role in the creation of history. Both discuss the impact of the production process, context, setting, and interviewer, interviewee, or narrator relationship as central. Indeed, the interaction between the interviewer and the narrator is a crucial dimension of oral history. Oral historians do more than document memory, they elicit it. And therein lies a shared authority, as certain questions will guide the interview process and elicit certain responses. Oral history is thus the collaborative creation of evidence in narrative form between interviewer and narrator, between living human beings. The spoken word is also embedded in a setting, a situation, a context. People speak with body language, expression, and tone, and many people learn to communicate not with the precision or brilliance of their words, but with energy and affect. I have learnt this when a vibrant interview has been reduced in the transcript to a series of leaden, banal sentences. Also, sometimes it is more important what is not being said than what is being said. For example, when I interviewed former political prisoners of Number 4 Women's Jail in Johannesburg in the original isolation cells where they were tortured, it clearly had a very strong emotional impact on the interviewees as vivid recollections flooded in. Their words were just the bare outline. Their stories were just as much told in their anguished expressions, subtle cues of tone, pauses, posture, breathing, body language. All aspects of an interview that are outside words, the unworded dimensions that can be caught on film. So thinking about film in this respect, how can documentary film become activism? How can oral history, collecting survivor testimony, be turned into other forms of narrative, such as documentary film, to become a form of activism? In terms of the process, Dan Sipe points out that, quote, when images are edited into constructed presentations, historians must also engage the logic of the filmed word, a primarily visual dimension with its own codes for how evidence can constitute and communicate historical statements. He goes on to comment on the disjunction between the practice of historians based in academia and the practice of history in society. While more conservative historians remain deeply wedded to writing, he argues, documentary films, especially broadcast on television, are the major influence on the public's historical consciousness. It implies the greater potential of film to reach wider audiences and hence greater room for activism and outreach. The director of Hoop Dreams and Interrupters, Steve James, offers a journalistic perspective on the responsibility of the documentary filmmaker and why it is so crucial to use the documentary as an instrument for social change in his essay, We Aren't Sorry for This Interruption. In it, he states that the documentary film has two essential purposes, quote, to reveal the world and or to change the world. He explains that documentary's dual role of film presentation and public outreach means that it pursues both a creative and journalistic truth while used to affect positive social change. He says, quote, "The ultimate effectiveness of the latter is due in large part to the integrity of the former." James's assertion emphasizes a sought-for objectivity of journalistic reportage, which will make the film a reliable source without ulterior agendas. Screening Truth to Power, a read on documentary activism, is not only a fascinating read for anyone curious about documentary's role in socio-political activism, but its diverse perspectives from documentary professionals and scholars can also offer some unique insights into effectively using the genre to speak or screen truth to power. Drawing on the testimonies from the Ubuntu prison archive and other archival footage, Music Beyond Borders, in collaboration with Afrovision — Afrovision is based in Cape Town, headed by award-winning filmmaker Brian Tilley — is currently in production with a documentary film about music in the apartheid prisons and its crucial role as a tool for resistance, survival, and propelling social justice by political prisoners during the struggle. Afrovision is now legendary as a film collaborative headed by four filmmakers who illegally documented the underground struggles in South Africa from the early 1980s until liberation, and worked closely with the unions and civil society organizations within South Africa and the ANC in exile. Their archive, built up during this time, is the most comprehensive and in-depth of the period, running to 3,000 hours. It covers strikes, township clashes with police, funerals, union congresses, students and communities organizing, and many other struggle events. And you can find curated extracts called History Uncut from Afrovision's footage on their website if you're interested. So while I can't actually screen whole portions of the film yet, we're currently still fundraising through our Music Beyond Borders website to raise funds to finish the film. I'd like to share some key moments in the narrative with you, which I hope will exemplify the richness of the oral history materials and give an idea of some of the main indelible, unforgettable characters that we're working with. Our characters are nearing the end of their lives. All of their stories center on a miracle, because none of the characters expected to get out of prison when they did, and none of them expected apartheid to slip into history without tremendous upheaval. The ex-prisoners we meet came from all walks of life, from different languages, ethnic traditions, and held contrasting political beliefs. They experienced different prisons, and the film is threaded around specific songs that they have a narrative, a struggle story around, that was a particular song or music that was central to their survival, against — and this is interwoven against the historical footage which of this apartheid period, which creates a constant backdrop to their experiences. But in every prison, they were each other's lifeline and had two goals: to defy apartheid and to survive. And in this, music was an essential key. So to show you the first clip shows Mark Shinners, who was a Robben Island prisoner. He arrived on Robben Island when he was 17 years old and served 2 10-year terms for being a member of a banned organization and conspiring to overthrow the government. With an affable and philosophical temperament, Shinners articulates his insights into those violent times with the clarity and wisdom of a poet. He was later a representative of the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, negotiators in the talks that resulted in the first democratic government in South Africa. Anthony Souze, who also appears in this clip, was sentenced to 15 years on Robben Island in 1963 for his membership of the Pan-Africanist Congress and for mobilizing other students. Known for his fiery temper and athletic abilities, his and Mark's activities as soccer players in the Makana Football Association, which was formed on the island, are recounted in the docudrama and book More Than Just a Game by Chuck Kaur. So in this clip that I'm going to show you, Shinners and Souze talk about the impact of music in the struggle to take activists to a particular state of mind to confront violence and potential death. And then in prison, particularly when the prisoners were taken for hanging, they say, "We are not intimidated, we are not afraid."
Songs are inspirational, they create the mood. And so if you want to go into a fight, you sing, and the song will be fit that particular moment. And as Mark has said, they couldn't, the struggle, you would not get into the struggle without the struggle or into a fight situation without the right frame of mind. How do you create the right frame, that frame of mind? You sing, and the song becomes an opium, the opium that takes over the body, mind, and soul. And once you are transfixed in that situation, your fears vanish. If you are angry, your anger heightens. And so that's what music did in the struggle. And in prison, we use music to either show our anger, to lighten our misery, to just to celebrate situations. When we are happy, we sing certain kinds of songs. When we are depressed and sorry, we sing certain kinds of songs. I mean, there's a song that we sang when those prisoners were taken out of the cells for hanging, you remember? And that song, how did it go, Mark? I'll remember the lyrics. But that song actually says, we are not afraid. We are not afraid. You can do whatever you do. You can come at night and steal some of us and take them for him. We are not intimidated. We are not afraid.
The second clip I want to show you focuses on the musical activities that brought relief to the back-breaking daily hard labour that Robben Island has spent in the stone quarry. Men wielded hammers weighing over 13 pounds, sweated and toiled, talked and debated and sang for 8 hours to the point of exhaustion. African work songs at Robben Island provided both a rhythmic work pace and a sense of unity in overcoming the daily hardships. Work songs drew on a tradition of migrant labourers' folk songs, which were widespread in apartheid South Africa, and offered satirical commentaries about their white oppressors and the state of the nation. So specific songs were sung on the various labour tasks of Robben Island. And this particular example I'm going to share with you today is a work song called Isandla Funindao. So after a stone had been freshly quarried out of the rock faced by the hammers, a rope was tied around it and it was dragged out of the ditch and up a smooth incline to the loading area by a double row of men on the rope span. The extra effort required to pull the stone out of the ditch required a more powerful chant or song. And often a chant would start off softly, repeated over and over again like a mantra, and slowly increasing in volume and urgency. Isandla funindao, funindao, isandla funindao, funindao. It's a call for hands. Let the hand find a holding place. Let's a shoulder, lend a shoulder. As everyone clutched the rope, the words changed to isandla genalap, genalap. Push your hand in here in the space, in preparation for the huge physical effort that would follow as the tempo and volume of the chant increased and peaked, each prisoner echoing the leader. Ensukinsuku, ensukinsuku, now we lift. When the stone came out of the ditch and landed on the level ground before the incline, a grunt of unanimous satisfaction could be heard. Kokomoyo, meaning take a breather. In this clip here, the group of former Robben Islanders that we got together in the recording studio sang this work song and automatically did the physical movements with it.
You have been listening to Music, Race, Incarceration, and Survivor Testimonies from Apartheid South Africa on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Dr. Janie Cole from the University of Cape Town speak about apartheid prisoners and their relationship with music. Dr. Cole is the founder of Music Beyond Borders, an organization that aims to research crimes against humanity through music. She is also creating a documentary called Keeping Time, the story of music in the apartheid prisons. Dr. Cole came to speak at Indiana University on February 10th. Now return to the program.
Another important aspect of the film, which I was alluding to earlier, are the women's stories, which bring to the forefront sexual and racial discrimination, sexual harassment and abuse, gender politics, and how female prisoners cope. Our main character in this narrative is Tenjiwe Umtitsu. She was the daughter of a domestic worker and a trade unionist from Soweto who became aware of the racial disparities in society at 16 years old and started to strike at work. At Fort Hare University, her activism grew when she met Steve Biko and joined a communal group around his Black Consciousness movement. She was detained in multiple women's jails where she suffered extreme brutality for her proximity to Biko. Umtitsu was legendary for her refusal to provide information or break down and cry while being interrogated in the harshest conditions. Armed with a will of iron and a depth of humanity beyond her years, Umtitsu joined the armed struggle in exile where she learned to respect a gun, she says. She served as the Deputy Secretary General of the ANC after liberation and is currently the South African Ambassador to Romania. So to conclude, with Music Beyond Borders South African project, this research continues to evolve into what I hope will be a significant cultural heritage preservation initiative and also an accurate historical documentation of the apartheid era and music's critical role as resistance in the wider struggle and apartheid prisons, celebrating the victory of the unknown individuals who never lost hope in a free and democratic South Africa for all. Thank you very much.
You are documenting songs from prison cells, but those same songs sound very familiar to those of us who pass by the liberation camps, for those who were outside of South Africa, for example, in the ANC camp in Morogoro, in Tanzania. You could hear these similar songs. Are you going to have a way of linking the two, prison and free, or not quite free?
Well, that's. Thank you for bringing
it's a
that
kind
up.
Of prison too.
Absolutely, and thank you for bringing it up because it's a really important point and a very important aspect of that whole musical struggle narrative. As we know, the MK camps in and training camps in exile. Guerrillas in those neighbouring countries around South Africa were hotbeds for music and for song, and it was another way of keeping the soldiers going. And I think there's a lot of crossover, and there's a constant, because as they were being trained in the camps, and they would come back into the country, and then they would be in the struggle and in the protest, and then maybe they'd get arrested and then get in prison, and then there would be the whole transmission of this repertory, in the crowds and then as political prisoners. So it's a very, very important aspect to take into account in the narrative, I think. What the focus that I'm taking is on the apartheid prison space specifically, because if you look at the general narrative of music and the anti-apartheid struggle, it's so vast and so little has been done in a systematic way from the research point of view, that the prisons allow us to start with one section of it. But music in the training camps and the guerrillas is definitely another very, very important aspect. And in fact, Denji Weumtitsu, who we heard, you know, at various points during my talk, she spent a lot of time in those camps, and I think she was in Angola at one point. And when we had the interview, she talked about her prison experiences, but then there was a whole other part of the interview which focused on her experiences of music in the camps, which is also why we're creating this digital archive of the oral testimonies and the struggle stories and music, because I have my musicological questions about the prison spaces, but then you end up with a two-hour interview with whoever you're talking with about their whole experiences in the struggle, which aren't necessarily conditioned on that prison space. Yes.
I'd be curious about how your musicological training was reflected in your use of these sources.
Well, that's a whole other discourse. One of the aspects that I'm looking at in terms of the Freedom Songs repertory and particular political songs in that wider struggle narrative is looking how, in terms of the harmonic framework and melodic motifs that are developed, how you can see certain tribal strands within that. So, mostly when you have the publications that are out on music in the struggle, look at the texts. But I think, and this is a very, I'm still very new to this research, this part of the research, I think within the actual musical aspects and specific components, let's say, of the framework of a song, you can also trace what's going on in a struggle narrative and in terms of the background and the genealogy of the song.
Yeah. Dr. Cole, thank you so much for a wonderful and insightful presentation.
Thank
you. I'm really curious, either based in text or based musicologically, apartheid ended years ago. There's been time in between that and the current time which you're showing this. And how does that memory of kind of post-apartheid also encourage songs? Are people creating songs looking back on apartheid? Are these groups performing for other South Africans to educate other South Africans about this history? So not just looking at the songs within the prisons, but how has music been a part of post-apartheid memory for these musicians?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that I'm not dealing with musicians as such, because they're wonderful singers, but they're basically former prisoners. But singing and music is such a central part of South African culture that, you know, they've got a huge post-apartheid era of repertory reflecting and memorializing on that earlier period. Interestingly, fast forwarding right to the present now, in South Africa, we're in the midst of a fairly volatile time with protests at all the tertiary institutions since 2015, which started with the Roads Must Fall campaign, went into the Fees Must Fall, and there have been a lot of protests, marches. I'm based in Cape Town, which is where I've seen what's going on, and I've been documenting some of it. And when at the University of Cape Town, when there are marches going on, they're always accompanied by singing. You hear the singing first before you see the crowd. And one thing that I've noticed listening to the repertories, and don't quote me on this because I'm sure that I haven't been present at every single march there, but there seems to be more of an emphasis. A lot of the freedom songs are being sung, and a lot of that older repertory, and then being reworked with new variants of text, which is what was happening during the anti-apartheid struggle, you know, to mirror what was going on the ground. So that's, but there seems to be more of a choice away from the ANC repertory and more PAC and other parties, which I don't know if that's a reflection on the state of mind and you know, a statement in itself in terms of the present government? Question mark. Yes.
Back to a methodological question. I don't know exactly where it would lead, depending on your answer. But could you imagine that every musical performance is a form of oral testimony, an oral history in its own way? And conversely, could we conceive it all of oral histories as being music in a way, having a rhythm, having a structure that in some way relates to musical performance?
Yeah, I think that's a very neat way of looking at it, and I think it works in both directions. I mean, you know, especially looking at the music from this period, it's certainly a reflection and a mirror of the oral, of the story behind it, and the and that oral history within, embedded in the text, in the notes, in the, you know, all those different aspects that make up a song. But having also interviewed, and, you know, I was referring to this, I think, in my talk when talking about the body language and the rhythm and the pauses and the silences, that is also a form of musicality within the spoken word, for sure. I think that's a very, very nice way of looking at it.
You have just finished listening to Dr. Janie Cole from the University of Cape Town's talk about South African apartheid prisoners and their relationship with music. Dr. Cole is a musicologist and the founder of Music Beyond Borders. She is also creating a documentary entitled Keeping Time, the story of music in the apartheid prisons. Dr. Cole came to IU on February 10th.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.